danger is stealing in as relapse comes above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day when you give in. Give in. Give in. Give in.
Hello and welcome to episode 238 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Owings Mills, Maryland. I am Andrew Brokus. I will be joined soon by Nate Mavis and also by our guest, Brad Willis, for the strategy segment and the introduction. I will be by myself. So if you despise the sound of my voice but love the rich baritones of Nate and Brad, then you can feel free to skip ahead to the interview. Otherwise, we will talk some strategy. And I guess first I'll tell you, for those who don't know Brad Willis, this is his second appearance on the show. Brad is an old school poker person. I mean, not old school, but he kind of predates the poker boom in terms of his interest in poker. So he's got a kind of rich history with poker. He's currently the head of blogging for Poker Stars. So he does a lot more writing about poker than he does playing poker. But he's a really fascinating guy. His own, insightful guy. He has also his own blog at Rapid Eye Reality, which is always a great read. He writes a lot about, fatherhood, kind of family-related issues, sometimes stuff related to poker, sometimes related to the American South. He lives in South Carolina. We'll talk some about that in today's interview. This is, it's his second appearance on the show. So I'll put a link to his first appearance on the show notes, which is where we talk a little bit more about his story. To be honest, coming into today's interview, I actually didn't have a real clear idea of what we were going to talk to Brad about. I was thinking that I was going to re-listen to our previous interview with him and get caught up a little bit on Rapid Eye Reality and see what he's been up to. I overslept the morning of the interview. I woke up just a few minutes before we were going to start recording. Didn't have time to do any of that. I seriously considered, maybe just rescheduling the interview or something. And but Brad seemed like he was in the mood to talk. And as I said, he is a very capable raconteur and just a kind of overall very insightful and interesting person. So we decided to do what we often do with only slightly more preparation, which is just sort of let the recorder roll and see what we talk about. So this is not one of our most poker heavy episodes, but I think the overall discussion is quite interesting. And, we talk some about the current political situation in the United States, not even so much at the level of electoral politics, although there's some of that. Brad is sort of a progressive person living in a not terribly progressive area overall, or area where progressive politics is not always that welcome. So he talks some about that. And also just kind of generally about raising sons in this current, I don't want to suggest that, kind of like sexual harassment or sexual predatorship or anything like that is really a new phenomenon, but that it seems to be a moment where it's getting more attention than it traditionally has in the United States. And so he talks some about raising sons in that climate and what kinds of things he wants to teach his sons. And we do talk some poker as well. And we talk again about the idea of talking politics at the poker table and the extent to which the poker table is kind of a place where one of the more ideologically diverse spaces that that some of us participate in. I mean, there's so much talk about living in bubbles and people who just kind of live and interact primarily with people who share broadly their views on politics and ethics and what's right and important in life. And the poker table is one of the places where we're most likely to encounter people who are who think differently than we do. And there's kind of a question of, well, what do we do about that? I mean, should we use that space to try to bridge those differences, or is the fact that we don't explicitly discuss those differences the thing that makes it possible or palatable to occupy that space? In other words, would the poker table just be insufferable? Or I think that it would be insufferable if it just turned into nothing but kind of people partisan sniping at each other in you know, the way that Twitter can sometimes look like. And I know I've been responsible for my share of that. So yeah, a lot of interesting stuff to discuss with Brad. Other things to tell you, the end of the year is approaching, which means that the holiday gift-giving season is approaching. Possibly for you, it has already begun. And when you are buying gifts this season, remember there is knitcast.com, which is where you'll find our line of premium podcasts, as well as Nate's Thinking Tournament Poker series and my Thinking Poker Diaries books. And if you find yourself doing any shopping on Amazon, you can help Nate and me out by using our affiliate link. It won't cost you anything additional, but we will get a little kickback from your purchase. To do that, you'll go to thinkingpoker.net, click on the Support the Podcast tab, and then choose the appropriate link for your country. Finally, if you are looking to give us a gift, well, I can't speak for Nate, but what I would really appreciate is a donation to my end-of-the-year fundraising campaign for the Bay Area Urban Debate League. This is an organization with which I've worked closely for several years, so I can attest both to the effectiveness of this particular organization and the dedication of its leadership and its staff and the quality of its programming, but I can also just kind of speak to the value of debate generally, both as someone who I personally benefited quite a bit from participating in high school and to some extent college debate, and also, you know, have worked with various urban debate leagues around the country and have seen the great things that they can do in terms of improving the lives and the life prospects of kids in some of this country's most troubled schools. As an extra incentive for contributing to this campaign, there's going to be a couple of rewards. First, everybody who contributes at least $10 will be entered in a drawing to win prizes, to include a custom coaching video, an opportunity to appear on the Thinking Poker podcast and talk strategy with Nate and me, a free item from the Knitcast store, and more. Plus, for every $1,000 that the campaign raises, not $1,000 that you personally contribute, for every $1,000 that the campaign raises, I'll create an hour's worth of poker strategy content. Might be audio, might be video, maybe there'll be guests. I'll still have to sort out some of the details, but it'll be top quality stuff, and it'll be freely available. So the more we raise, the more great strategy material I'll put out there. And of course, you'll have my gratitude. This is a cause that's really important to me. And this campaign has been quite successful in the past. Podcast listeners have been very generous, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. And we'll appreciate everyone who helps out with a year-end gift this year. To make a contribution to that campaign, you're going to go to razoo.com, R-A-Z-O-O.com. And I think the easiest way to find it is just to search for my last name, which is Brokos, B as in boy, R-O-K-O-S. Or if you go to thinkingpoker.net and find the show notes for this or one of our recent podcast episodes, this is not the last time you'll hear about the campaign, and you can click the link in the show notes to make a contribution in that way. Another possible great holiday gift, whether for someone else or possibly if you're looking to treat yourself, would be a subscription to Tournament Poker Edge. For as little as $25 a month, you can give or receive the gift of high-quality poker strategy content specific to tournament poker, although in many cases, I think, at least speaking for my own videos, I think a fair bit of it is useful even if you're not tournament specific, but really covering a wide range of stakes, live and online poker, various poker tournament formats, and coming from a wide variety of instructors, including myself, including Nate, including many people you've heard as guests on this podcast over the years. If you enjoy the poker strategy content on this show, you'll find tons and tons and tons more of it at www.tournamentpokeredge.com. Strategy question today is coming to us from Mark. Mark says, "Hi guys, thanks for all of your great content. Recently I checked out the Just Hands podcast after hearing you talk about the event that you've done with its creators. In a recent episode, they made some comments about changing seats and tables, which made me think that I'd love to hear your opinions. Changing seats. How do you feel about changing seats to get position on players? As far as in-game strategy is concerned, my understanding is you mainly want loose players on your right and tight players on your left, and you don't care terribly much how well they play after the flop. Is that true, at least as a first approximation, or should I be more concerned about factors relating to skill? As far as metagame thinking goes, you don't want to give off too much information or annoy the other players at the table. The Just Hands guys said they don't like to move just to the left of a fish for fear that the player will leave, presumably because they would feel insulted. But in my experience, weak players will more likely assume you're getting a seat change for comfort, eyesight, or luck-based reasons, e.g. the seat is hot. I don't, however, tend to change seats more than once per session for Kantian reasons. If everyone is jumping around all the time, it can slow down the game a lot. I'd love to hear your thoughts about why and when to change seats in a live cash game. Very interesting question. One thing I'll say off the top is this is a topic that Tommy Angelo discusses a little bit in Elements of Poker. So there's a zillion good reasons to read Elements of Poker. Elements of Poker, by the way, would make an excellent holiday gift for any poker fan. In fact, Elements of Poker is the only poker book that my mother has ever read, just because she has kind of an interest in like yoga and meditation kind of stuff, which is also an interest of Tommy's, and he makes some references to it in Elements of Poker. So even people who are not terribly big fans of poker, if you want to give them a little bit of exposure to poker and how poker players think, Elements of Poker I found useful for that purpose. But that's an aside. So Tommy talks a little bit about some reasons why you might want to change your seats. I think Mark raises a good and important point. I want to make sure it didn't go over people's heads when he says for Kantian reasons. What I think he's referring to is the idea that if everyone in a poker game behaved in a way that, you know, they were always trying to maximize the seat that they were sitting in, it would just be kind of a mess. You know, every time a seat opened up, there would be kind of jostling to see who was going to get it, and maybe, and this, I mean, you do actually see this happen sometimes, and it is annoying. You get the like musical chairs effect where a seat opens up, and then someone's like, I'm going to take that seat, and then someone's like, I'm going to take his seat, I'm going to take his seat, and you know, in theory, you could even just, you know, make circles around the table and never play, just constantly trying to optimize seats. So I think he's right that you should have a relatively high bar for changing seats. I also think it matters a little bit just in terms of how it's received by your local community. I think this is the kind of thing where various community norms can exist. And I know the first casino that I used to play in regularly was the Rivers Casino in Pittsburgh. And it was pretty common there to see people changing seats for a variety of reasons, many of which I think had to do with getting position on certain players. And so that was something that I did, you know, pretty aggressively as well. And when I started playing more regularly in the Maryland area, I got some, you know, criticism, I guess, from some of the other regulars in the game, kind of saying that was like petty or obnoxious or something like that. And it just seemed like it was being received differently in that community. And it's something that I've largely stopped doing, just because, you know, I think it is kind of a nice equal, like, again, because it would be to everyone's detriment if everyone tried to optimize seats. You know, a nice sort of equilibrium on that is that none of the regulars really try to do it. And so if no one's doing it, then, I mean, it kind of becomes a problem if someone breaks that truce and, you know, starts, you know, really aggressively hopping seats. And maybe you can use, as people did with me, I guess, use some social program to discourage people from doing that. But I think just in terms of how it's going to affect the game at like a meta level, I think you just kind of have to be able to read the conditions a little bit. But assuming that you've decided that you're going to try to some degree to optimize, or even just if you have a choice when the game is starting or when you move to a table, you have a choice of which seat to take, I think that there are some good strategic considerations. One that Mark mentioned is wanting to have tighter players on your left. I think there's something to that. You know, your ability, if you think about like maybe your open raising range from the cutoff, it should to some degree be a function of who's on the button. So if the button is a very good player, someone who's going to do a good job of defending his button, who's going to call well, who's going to three bet well, you're going to have to be a little tighter on the cutoff. Whereas if the button is an extremely tight player and you know the button is, you know, going to fold more than he should when you open raise from the cutoff, well, now you can get away with raising some hands from the cutoff that might not be profitable with a different player on the button. So I definitely think there's something to that. Possibly an even more important factor, and this is something we discussed a little bit with Matt Glassman, I think, the last time that he was on the show. Maybe this is just a conversation I had with Matt off air, but in any event, also I think paying attention to stack depth is underappreciated, but sometimes you'll see a game where stack depths can vary wildly, like maybe a 1-2 game with a $300 max buy-in. Many people are only buying in for $100, But occasionally you see someone run up a stack of $1,000. And if you yourself have $1,000, I think it makes a big difference to be on the left of the other player who has $1,000, even if it means, you know, even if that is like a looser player or something, even if that is like a tighter player where ordinarily not maybe someone you'd be too concerned about having position on them, but just when you're that deep, just kind of consistently being in better position anytime you play large pots, like position matters less when you're shallow. So letting people who only have 50 big blinds have position on you is not that big of a deal. And when you're 500 big blinds deep with somebody, consistently being in position on that player really makes a big difference. I think that's one factor that people don't pay enough attention to. Is just trying to be, you know, avoid having players, if you have a deep stack yourself, avoid having players who cover you on your immediate left, especially if they're good players, and try to have players, if you cover or close to covering somebody, trying to have those people on your right. I think that's probably even more important, actually, than how tight or loose they are before the flop. Mark also says maybe you don't care terribly much how well they play after the flop. I don't think there's a lot of reason why that would be true. Maybe if the game is very shallow, such that post-flop decisions tend not to be that important. Like, I think this would actually matter more in a tournament where you don't get options to choose your seat anyway. But yeah, I mean, especially in a deeper stacked cash game, like there's plenty of reasons why having a tough player on your left is going to make things difficult on the flop and the turn and the river. But when you're very shallow, position tends to matter less because you're more just playing not that it doesn't matter, but it becomes more about just playing the current strength of your hand rather than having to project forward to future decisions, which is where position is most valuable, is knowing that people are going to make better decisions than you if they have position on you on future streets. It's harder to realize your equity when you're out of position, and especially when you're deep. Yeah, I think that's most of what I want to say about this. I mean, I guess the other like meta issue about changing seats is just in terms of whether it's going to like insult somebody if you're really blatantly moving to that person's left. And I think that's just something that you have to judge on a case-by-case basis, how much you think it's going to matter, or you know, how much you think they're going to notice or care that you're doing that. I don't know if there's a broad rule to that. But again, you do get that problem of if everyone is like jostling to get on that player's left, it's going to be sort of obvious. And so I think you just kind of have to make an in-game assessment of what will be the consequence for the quality of the game and the annoyance of other players and potentially even scaring off someone that you want to keep in the game if you're aggressively changing seats. But I do think there's value to it. And I think that especially when a game is starting, you should put some thought into where you're going to sit. Thanks for the excellent question, Mark. And let's go talk to Brad and Nate.
This is episode 230-something of the Thinking Poker Podcast. We've had a lot of great guests on. Our first conversation, though, changed my life more than any other episode of the Thinking Poker Podcast, because you introduced me to a lot of music that is now, like, a part of not just my listening rotation, but, like, my worldview. So I absolutely must know, what are you listening to these days?
Well, I'm so glad you said that. When you're like, you changed my life, I'm like, oh, God, what have I done?
Much for the better.
I was like, oh, my gosh, more therapy. What am I listening to? Goodness gracious. I mean, it's been, a couple of years since I talked to you, so I'm not exactly sure where I was last time, but
it has been almost exactly 2 years.
Israel, Mandolin Orange.
Oh, you know, okay, so I talked about Mandolin Orange. I saw them again in Nashville last year and was able to, like, stand, like, 5 feet from Emily Franz, who I'll confess I've developed a crush on that even my wife has come to understand and accept. I mean, she's completely fine with it at this point. But, yeah, I mean, we talked about Sturgill Simpson last time, who at the time was just sort of coming up and becoming big. And, you know, he has since gone on to become really big and produce his own things, and but he just produced an album for another guy that I'm listening to right now that is sort of like Sturgill was a few years ago. His name's Tyler Childers, and He's this redheaded singer-songwriter who sounds like he came straight out of the mountains, and you know, sings a lot of songs about, you know, drugs and booze, but also sings, you know, these sort of sappy love songs. And Sturgill Simpson produced his last album, and it's called Purgatory. And if you listen to it, you can actually hear some of Sturgill's influence there. And Paul, not quite as deeply political as Sturgill can be in some of his songs, you can hear like an undercurrent. And I think eventually he's going to get around to the point to where he'll have some of that same political bent that Sturgill has, and can change some of your ideas. So that's one. I've been listening to a band called Green Sky Bluegrass a lot recently, which I don't know. Jam grass may not necessarily be your bag of donuts, but it's I've been, you know, listening to acoustic music for pretty much the last, you know, 30 years or so, and eventually you get to the point to where you can only hear like the Doc Watson, Earl Scruggs, G Run on the guitar, you know, without having to, you know, die. And but the this jam grass scene, which has been around for a long time, you know, is basically like, you know, if you spend a whole bunch of times at hippie music festivals and then add that together with bluegrass, you end up with jam grass. And so there's a band called Green Sky Bluegrass that is very, very listenable, and I'm not sure it's going to change your worldview, but you might have a good time listening to it.
Fantastic.
And then One other one real quick is a guy named John Moreland. I don't know if you've run across him yet, but no. he's this look him up. He might actually be one of the first places that you'll enjoy. He's this gigantic, you know, like bear of a man out of Tulsa, and he writes these really, really nice songs that, you know, you would think might come out of, you know, you imagine the scene on in an Animal House where the guy's singing the folk song on the stairs and Belushi comes down and beats the hell out of his guitar. You know, it's sort of that same spirit, but with this sort of gravelly, you know, whiskey gargling voice, and out of a man that looks like he, you know, could have been, you know, a Hell's Angel at some point. And so, yeah, he hangs out with this band called Turnpike Troubadours that, you know, sort of a bubblegum.
Oh, come on.
No, they are the bubblegum. No, I like the Turnpike Troubadours. I always preface it with, you know, with people thinking of, you know, Brad listens to one of this sort of hard-edged political stuff, that the Turnpike Troubadours sound a little bubblegum until you start listening to their lyrics a little bit more closely and realize, you know, how much they're talking about basically our current situation in America and a, you know, 15, 16-year war. So he opens for the Turnpike Troubadours quite a bit.
Yeah. No, I mean, and point taken, it's I'm somewhat less likely to want the Turnpike Troubadours played at my funeral than some of these other bands we're talking about. that's a damn fine band you're talking about. So.
Oh, no, I mean, I've seen them a couple of times, and it's the pretty much the soundtrack to everything that happens here at the Willis household. Everybody, you know, my kid knows half the words. And we were sitting on the couch two nights ago, and he's like, teach me how to play this one. And, you know, it was a Turnpike Troubadour song. We're sitting on the couch singing it together.
Fantastic. You listening to Blake Mills at all?
I don't know Blake Mills.
This is neither did I, and neither did Brian Koppelman until Jason Isbell mentioned him on The Moment. And he's really good. He's just a guy with a guitar singing about various things.
That's pretty much my wheelhouse.
and the guitar is very good, and it has, you know, it's different from the acts we're talking about, but similar in spirit. I would recommend it, and judging by the number of plays on Spotify and so on, he's a little bit under the radar.
Well, good. That's the kind of people I like to find. You know, I don't know if you've ever run across or heard about it, the Americana Music Festival. It's in Nashville every year, and you can go out and, you know, for $60 you can get a wristband, and there's, you know, 200 or 300 showcases over the course of a week, and you can go out there and just watch band after band or artist after artist and find a lot of people that are really, really fun to watch in this genre of music, and you know show up to see, you know, Reckless Kelly, and, you know, run into this folk singer named Joe Purdy who, you know, can sing a 5-minute song, you know, called Children of Privilege, and, you know, sounds sort of like Bob Dylan talking to, you know, millennials of today. It's fun.
Nice. All right, so we've done the thing that I absolutely needed to do. I think it makes for good podcasting, but
I hope so. Right, everybody else, wake up.
big selfish motive there.
No, I certainly wanted to do the same thing. And, you know, I don't listen, I think, to probably just as much music in general, but, I mean, I certainly consider, I don't know, maybe even painting too broad of a brush to just call this, like, country western or something, but it's certainly the genre that I'm least familiar with, or, you know, bluegrass as
coastal
well.
Coastal elite doesn't know how to feel. That's what we're dealing with here.
But let me finish where I'm going with. This one is probably a lot more mainstream than the names that you guys are bandying about, but Margot Price is one that I've become enamored with recently.
Sure. I mean, she's you know, East Nashville famous right now. I mean, she became a little bit more famous over the course of the last year because, you know, some of the people she's associated with. But, you know, she's good and everybody knows her now. And that's not a bad thing. You know, I think a lot of people for a long time thought, well, you know, if somebody knows who you are, you've sold out. And that's it. You know, you're done as far as being artistically interesting. And that's clearly not the case. I mean, you look at Jason Isbell and, you know, he owns all his own stuff. He doesn't really get played on the radio that much, or at least terrestrial radio. And he's, you know, more famous, you know, than most, you know, good artists now that aren't necessarily your pop country artists. And, you know, Sturgill Simpson's the same way. I mean, the guy's doing great. He's producing his own albums. He's, you know, separated from his labels and being able to, you know, he's either works for Atlantic and he can produce his own stuff. And then he's standing outside, the country western or country music awards the other night, cause saying he can't get a ticket and, you know, busking for the ACLU outside the venue. I mean,
that's awesome. But sorry, speaking of the people who do get played on country radio, Chris Stapleton's new album, what do you think of it?
You know, I like Chris Stapleton a lot, but for some reason I haven't been able to listen to that album as many times as I probably need to appreciate it as much. And I don't know necessarily why that is. And it may be because I, you know, over the course of a year and a half, I got, you know, pretty Chris. I spent a lot of time with Chris Stapleton. But, you know, spending a lot of time with Chris Stapleton means sometimes, you know, especially for a guy like me, it means you also spend a ton of time with like a bottle of whiskey. And, maybe it just meant, you know, that I had to step back from both of those for a little bit.
Sounds good. It gets a thumbs up from me.
Good. I'll give it another run and just stay away from the liquor cabinet while I'm listening to it.
Yeah. And it's good. It's always, somewhere between, there's an element of relief when somebody who's getting a lot of radio time, you know, good first album, good second album too, I think. Maybe not quite as good as the first, but. Really well worth listening to. I think he's doing good work and very, very popular.
Yeah, and he holds on then to, you know, the what made him good to begin with. And, you know, I mean, he struggled for years, you know, and was never famous, but was writing songs for some of the best people in the world. And, you know, he was playing with, I can't remember the name of the band off the top of my head. Was it String Dusters, maybe? Whoever it was, he was playing with fronting a bluegrass band, and then he goes on and he's writing songs that Adele is doing on stage, but nobody knows who Chris Stapleton is, and all of a sudden he pops up on stage with Justin Timberlake, and everybody knows who he is. But he's still good, you know. I'd still go, you know, buy an expensive ticket tomorrow.
Well, I noticed, Brad, it's been, by coincidence, almost exactly 2 years since you were on the podcast. Your previous episode, we published it anyway on November 30th. I don't remember what day we recorded it on, but it's now November 29th when we're recording with you. What's been going on in Willis world since we last caught up?
You know, I sort of feel like, you know, it's weird because I live this ridiculously suburban life for a guy who has also spent, you know, 15 years or so in the poker industry. And it's weird to, you know, talk to what is oftentimes a poker audience about, you know, what I'm doing, because, it, you know, probably 80% of my life and the things that I do are so far outside poker. I spend, you know, countless hours at Little League baseball parks. You know, in fact, just before we hopped on, you know, to record today, I was, you know, setting up an online registration system for the Little League, you know, season for the spring that's coming up, because that's something that I guess an old poker guy does, is set up Little League registrations. But that, you know, that's what I do. I'm this, you know, weird family guy who lives in the South and, you know, works in the poker industry, but doesn't do other than the work that he does, doesn't do much else in poker.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to live in one of the worst places to be working in the poker industry.
Oh yeah, I mean, really, I mean, the closest place, the only place, really, for me to even go play that's in driving distance is Harris Cherokee in Western North Carolina, and that's maybe an hour and 45 minutes if I'm driving pretty quickly. But other than that, you know, I'm driving to Maryland, or I'm driving to Florida, or I'm driving to Mississippi or Cincinnati, or, you know, something like that. It's terrible. I mean, it's great for the underground games because the underground games are rich. But, you know, in terms of, like, you know, actually being able to work and do legit work, I'm flying somewhere every time.
Well, do let me know if you find yourself driving to Maryland anytime in the near future. But are you going to be going to doing any of the WSAP circuit stuff at Cherokee?
You know, as I guess some people might know, most of my work that I've done over the course of the years has been with PokerStars, and I've run their blog team for the past 13 years or so. And so, you know, the World Series, while I've gone to the World Series almost every year since I started, I don't do a lot of work for the rest of their brand. And so most of the stuff that I do in terms of traveling will be for a PokerStars related tour. That is not to say, however, that, you know, when the World Series circuit goes to Cherokee, that I don't pop up there either for some cash games or, you know, the odd one-off tournament or something, because there's this area of the world, and, you know, for those people who don't live in the Southeast, there's not a ton of places to play. Cherokee, North Carolina is overrun with people when the circuit is there, and the cash games are ridiculous, and the tournaments are huge because you have people coming from Atlanta and Charlotte and everywhere else because it's the closest place for anybody to play.
Do you feel like the just writing about poker is kind of enough to scratch the itch for you?
You know, it depends, because I think for the most part, you know, I mean, you do your strategy sessions at the beginning of your podcast, and that, you know, there's an audience for that. And that's something that I'm not particularly good at. You know, I can, especially because, you know, most of my learning in poker came, you know, back when, you know, Justin Bonomo was still young and coming up. You know, that's when I was learning about how to play poker. And so me being able to teach someone how to play today, you know, with, you know, perfect game theory and, you know, all these merged ranges or whatever, that's not what I do. I've always, you know, made the work that I do in poker writing about the people of poker. And it's these days, you know, for a long time, we had a really hard time figuring out what a poker person was, because when the online community came into the live world, there was this shift from, you know, big characters, you know, like your Mike Matisows and whoever else at that time, versus, you know, the young online grinders who put a hoodie on and put on sunglasses and have zero interest in media or being famous or anything, because, you know, sponsorship money dries up. All they want to do is make money, and which is fine. And that's, you know, completely understandable. But that makes my job a little bit different, because what I enjoy doing is writing about people and writing about stories. And in terms of, you know, playing a little bit up at Cherokee, that might scratch my itch for playing, but I don't know that I'm necessarily as satisfied with being able to write about poker folks as I was 10, 15 years ago. However, that is not to say that can't change, because I think there's another shift going on in the poker world now to where you're having a lot more, there's a lot more self-awareness, I think, among poker players right now in terms of whether it's about their health or about their mental health or about politics. And so I think there's a lot of opportunities there to write about the poker community now that weren't there 10 years ago.
What do you attribute that shift to?
Well, I mean, there's two things, I guess. In terms of health, you know, I think there was a lot more education, you know, available to, you know, the people of our generation on what it means to be healthy, whether that's mentally healthy or physically healthy. And, you know, as the poker world grew, there were so many more opportunities to be a degenerate, both mentally and physically. And and so, you know, you look at the people who, you know, burned out, who were part of the live poker world in the late 90s or early 2000s, and, you know, they burned out necessarily, but that they were always probably going to burn out. Whereas then you bring in thousands and thousands of people who haven't necessarily lived in that world before, but all of a sudden, here's an opportunity if you're playing in the live world to drink all day long if you want to. Here's an opportunity to score drugs if you want to. Here's an opportunity to eat badly, stay up all day, and basically burn your mind and body out over the course of, you know, a summer even if you want to. And so I think, you know, the people who realized, okay, we have to find a way to get a control on that and get a control on our bodies and our minds, decided this is how we're going to be successful. And so they did. And because of that, people who were looking up to poker players are seeing these healthy people. And so now you've got people like, say, Jason Kuhn, who is, you know, both mentally and physically very fit and also a very, very good player. And a lot of people look up to him for that. And I think, you know, you have a lot more role models like that than you do, you know, people who might have looked up to Devilfish, you know, 15, 20 years ago. Yeah, just picking that one out of the air. But it was an easy one. And, you know, I guess the other thing is, other than being a different generation of people and how we view health, I mean, there's no ignoring the fact that, you know, a year ago at this time, all of us were trying to figure out what in the hell just happened in America. And it wasn't just America. I mean, it was the UK. The UK had just dealt with the Brexit, and, you know, we were dealing with the election here, and that's changed everything. I mean, I don't think there's any part of American culture or world culture right now that hasn't been changed by this dynamic shift in politics and just culture in general. And that trickles down to the poker world. I mean, you see it, whether it's on Twitter or it's at the poker table, and you know, it happens. And, you know, I mean, you were talking to Glassman in your last podcast about this very thing, but whether it happens around, you know, with nine people sitting there, or it happens on Twitter, or it just happens, you know, walking down the hallway at the World Series, things have changed. You know, we're different people. I didn't think I was ever going to change or ever be surprised once I hit my 40s. And I've spent the past year so confused about what's happening that I'm not the same person that I was the last time you talked to me. I'm just not.
More specifically, what's changed?
I think, for the most part, I mean, I'll tell you from my perspective, because I can't speak for anybody but myself, and I'm still trying to figure it out for myself. But I think a year ago at this time, or maybe say 13 months ago, I felt like the American political system, the American culture was going to be at least relatively the same and maintain a status quo. Whether I liked it or I didn't matter. You know, that certain people were going to be in power, elections were going to happen the same way, our neighbors were going to speak to each other in the same way, and it was always going to be that way. You know, whether I'm talking to somebody at a neighborhood barbecue or I'm talking to somebody at the poker table, we're all going to talk to each other in the exact same way, which is we'll dance around a political issue if we want to, or we'll talk about it, but we'll talk about it in a way that, you know, makes everybody feel comfortable. And, you know, somebody's going to get elected and they're going to be there for 4 or 8 years, and then we're going to elect somebody else and nothing's really going to change. And then, you know, the election happened and everything that led up to that changed the way that I interact with my neighbors. It's not just a dance that we're doing anymore. We're either specifically avoiding topics or we're up in each other's faces. And I'm not an up in your face type of guy, but that's what's happened. You know, everything now is either divisive or not discussed at all. And there's this huge culture shift going on all around it, to where we're having to make corrections for how terrible things have really gotten, which is a good thing. I mean, I woke up this morning and the alert on my phone says Matt Lauer has been fired from NBC. You know, Matt Lauer, I can't even think of who the Matt Lauer of the poker world is going to be, but Matt Lauer is the last guy you think is going to be a jerk. And it turns out, you know, if NBC is correct, that he was. And that's not what you expect. I mean, the status quo has been shattered, and that, I mean, and in a lot of cases, that's fine. If men are being held to account for their bad actions, that's fantastic. But that doesn't mean that it isn't going to shake the foundation of everything that we understand.
Yeah. It's, I wonder if sort of sexual misbehavior is going to be to my son's generation what drunk driving is to mine.
Yeah, I hope so.
Or to ours, where it's one of these things where, I mean, and to be clear, I believe this about sexual misbehavior too, like personally, but I think a lot of people say, like, oh, you know, that's just boys being boys. That's a thing that happened. And I certainly hope that in the next generation it's just not okay. It's just something that is a totally inappropriate thing to do.
You know, I've got two sons. One is 8 and still thinks everything is beautiful in the world. One turned 13 over the summer, and he's a 7th grader. He's in middle school. And my relationship with him in the last year, you know, has changed because he's getting older, but it's also changed because of what I'm coming to understand about the country that he's growing up in and the community that he's growing up in. And I'm now speaking to him as I would speak to you, almost, not because I'm in a hurry to mature him, but because he needs to understand what's happening. And, you know, I mean, there was a situation at his school. I mean, he's in 7th grade, and, you know, there were people at his school and who were, you know, associated with a Snapchat sexual assault that was shared throughout the entire school. And I mean, I was not prepared to talk to him about that, but I had to. And so now, it doesn't matter what he comes home and tells me. I'm like, just tell me every story from beginning to end. I don't care how long it takes. And, you know, some are boring and some are ones to where we have to sit down and have a long talk about what, you know, what it means to be respectful to women, or what it means to be respectful for yourself, and what, you know, one decision, you know, the consequences it can have for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
That's not a bad thing, though.
I mean, if you listen to the show, you know, I'm a new father, and, like, right now, I'm just changing diapers, and that's the easy part, I think. Like, this is all just terrifying. It just, I've got a young son, and trying to figure out, like, I mean, it used to be you expected a level of decency from people in charge, and we don't have that now. And there's a kind of active correction that one has to do.
Yeah, I mean, your sleepless nights now are just by the necessity of having to change a diaper, but, you know, in 10, 12 years, your sleepless nights are just going to be staring at the ceiling, like, how in the hell do I talk to my kid about rape, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the kid still has a stuffed animal that, you know, sleeps in his bed with him, and I have to talk to him about rape, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, I'm still trying to figure it out myself.
Yeah, it's, if you figure it out, please tell me. It's, and thanks for, you know, thanks for fighting the good fight.
Has it changed the way that you, I mean, I guess this is more the election than the sexual misbehavior stuff, but, I mean, has it changed the way that you see the South or think about being a Southerner?
You know, this is an interesting topic because, number one, I didn't grow up in the South. I grew up in Missouri, which some people might still consider the South, but I moved to the South in 1997 to Mississippi, which I did not enjoy very much. But I moved to South Carolina in 1999, and I've decided to call my home here. And there's a couple of interesting things about the difference between the Midwest or the North and the South. And I think one of them that really still stands out to me this day is, I mean, yes, the South has its problems with racists, and that's undeniable. That being said, it's not as overt here as it is elsewhere. I would have thought, if you had asked me before, that the South was a much more racist place than, say, St. Louis, Missouri. But knowing St. Louis very well, I know that in St. Louis, there's probably far more racist in St. Louis than there are in Greenville, South Carolina, where I live. But it's more accepted there. You know, it's more accepted to talk about a black person or a Hispanic person than it would be down here. So a lot of the racism of the South is cloaked in tradition and heritage and everything like that, but is not quite what you might find in the Midwest. Now, in terms of how I view the South, I think the South is changing. And this is, a lot of people won't believe this, and people who are from another country will think, you know, the South of America is where the hicks and the hillbillies live, or the people who live, you know, the coastal elites, as you said, you know, they look at the South as a region of America that is either a flyover or doesn't count. And what's interesting about the South, especially in the last 10 years, is to watch a lot of people like me who weren't from here come here and establish it as our home, to watch a lot of the big big companies come to the South because, you know, admittedly there's a lot of, you know, tax breaks that you can find by moving here, but that changes the culture. I've got a French family that lives two doors away from me. Michelin North America has its headquarters here in Greenville. I went to a Thanksgiving party last week that had French folks who work for Michelin and then a bunch of German folks who work for BMW, who has a North American headquarters just down the road from us as well. We're changing everything here in just this little community, and that changes how the South works. And while it's still very, very difficult to live as a socially liberal person in the South, as I do, but I don't want to leave because I feel like there's a really good chance for this to be a part of America that we can be really, really proud of. I've got a super duper liberal friend from San Francisco who's lived here a little bit longer than I have. And she said to me once something that stuck with me, which was live among them. And I thought about that for a long time. And what that's come to sort of mean for my family and me is that, you know, we live here and we live as the people we are. We become friends with people that we might not necessarily share some of the same political ideas with. And we become friends and they get to know us as people, sometimes before they get to know what our politics are. And then eventually they come to realize that, hey, you know, the Willis family, they're pretty cool. I mean, they do all the Little League and they're there for the barbecues and, you know, they're friendly to my kids and, you know, they've taken care of us and they've helped us out. And, oh, my God, they also, you know, don't have a problem with black people or they don't have a problem with gay people. And what are we supposed to do with that situation? And sometimes, you know, I find that, you know, people's ideas about how they've grown up here in the South change having just lived among people with different ideas. And I'm not saying that I'm on a crusade because I'm not, but I also like the idea of living in a place to where I don't necessarily, you know, align politically with everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it is one of those... just kind of with the country getting more polarized, not just in terms of like people's opinions, but just ability to seek out echo chambers or whatever.
Well, it's very easy,
right? Well, I mean, like what you're talking about is to some degree the opposite of that, like deliberately not seeking out the echo chamber.
It is. I mean, and not necessarily in a way to where, like, I would hate read a conservative Twitter feed because that'll just, I'll boil over. But, there is work to be done in just understanding the culture of a place you live in and hoping to influence it by how you live in a good way. I went to school with a woman who was much farther to the left than I'll ever be, you know. And then she went on to live in Ann Arbor for a while, which I'll, you know, further pushed her to the left. And she moved here, and while she's continued to live here, she can't acclimate because everything begins and ends with her as an argument. And I can't do that. I'd rather live among people and have long conversations with them, and maybe they'll come to understand how I feel about something more than just me telling them how they should feel.
Well, I think Twitter is tricky in that regard also because it... Well, I guess what you said specifically about, like, you know, hate following a conservative Twitter feed or something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's kind of easy to, like, choose your own straw man, essentially, doesn't always promote the most rational voices as much as the most like ideological voices or something. And I think it's easy to get a misperception. I mean, this isn't only Twitter. This is also like cable news and a zillion other things. But you know, I think it's easy to get a flawed perception of like, this is what a liberal looks like, or this is what a, you know, right-wing person looks like, or you know, talks like, or whatever. And it may even be that those are voices that are popular in liberal circles or in right-wing circles or something, but it doesn't necessarily make them representative of those people. And I think that the, you know, if your only entree or your primary entree into those people and those ideas is from a Twitter feed or from what you see on TV or whatever, you're going to get a skewed view of you know, what people believe and how strongly they believe it.
Yeah, I've curated my Twitter feed for, I guess, you know, I guess I've been on Twitter for 10 years now, I guess, to the point of where I can be informed but not infuriated every day. And that's sort of my goal on any given day. But, you know, I can't say that I follow a ton of different voices on Twitter, but I still learn from it. Twitter's interesting because I've loved Twitter for a long time, but I think it's also changed a lot in the last year. You know, some for the good and some for the bad. Like I've got a friend who I've known for several years who, like, you know, in following his Twitter feed, knew he was absolutely a genius. And whether I was reading his personal fiction writing or some of his blog work or stuff on Twitter, he, you know, the maybe at that point, the few hundred people who followed him knew he was a genius. And then on the day of the Charlottesville car attack, he put together a Twitter thread. More of it was a sort of like a raging Twitter thread against some of the things that was happening, some of the things that were happening at the time. And, you know, by the end of the day, he had, you know, had been retweeted by Patton Oswalt and Questlove and so many different people. I mean, he picked up more than 80,000 Twitter followers.
This must be Julian Scott.
Yeah, exactly. I'll say it's okay. You're familiar then.
Yeah.
And
I also followed him before he was famous.
What's that?
I also followed him before he was famous.
Oh, fantastic. See, and that's good. You know, I mean, I guess this is sort of the old hipster way of, you know, living life now. It's like, I followed that guy before he got retweeted by Patton Oswalt. and so, yeah, that's my one point of pride today is that I knew him a while back. So, you know, and I think he's been really, really good for, you know, some of the same causes that I believe in. But, you know, what's interesting is that for him to truly get across what he needs to say. I mean, he wrote a 25,000-word essay on America since the election, which was brilliant, by the way. If people haven't read it, just look for Bubbles by Julius Goat and start reading. But he put together this, he had to, you know, his everything that he does on Twitter is a thread. And I started thinking about it, and I'm like, you know, people don't talk about blogs anymore because blogs were stupid and blogs were passe, you know, and I've had one since 2001, but I felt like an old man for even maintaining it anymore. But now that the fact that, you know, Twitter has 280 words or characters per tweet, and everybody who wants to say anything threads their tweets all day long, basically we're just blogging in a forum that updates on people's screens or phones every day. You know, this morning, one of the very first stories about Matt Lauer wasn't like a deep look into who Matt Lauer was or even like a retrospective on who he was. It was, Matt Lauer was accused of this. Here are 20 tweets that people have put out. I mean, that was like the Indy Star. That was its, you know, its first news report this morning is, here's what everybody tweeted. Here's what Donald Trump tweeted about. And these days, it's, a lot of times, it seems like a lot of journalism is just, you know, we read Twitter and here's what we read on Twitter. And you know, don't get me started on this state of journalism right now. I spent a decade doing that, and you know, in traditional journalism, and having a hard time watching things right now.
I'm wondering if the we make a lot in the poker world of the poker table being like a place where there's, you know, a lot more diversity than you see in other social circles, like not even, and probably not even primarily, you know, like racial or ethnic diversity as much as just people of different generations and, you know, with high incomes and low incomes and traditional jobs and non-traditional jobs, just, you know, sort of a different sorts of people mixing in a way that they wouldn't in a lot of other spheres. But at the same time, we also have the, you know, don't talk politics at the poker table or sort of keep it light at the poker table. And on the one hand, I imagine that's kind of what enables that mixing, right? It's like it wouldn't be a pleasant place to mix if people were just sort of constantly fighting or like emphasizing their differences more so than their similarities. I mean, do you have thoughts on how we can sort of leverage that that unique thing that we have going on, the unique community that we have going on at the poker table in a way that would be productive rather than divisive? Or do you think that's even a true description of a poker table?
I mean, I think it definitely is because, I mean, I'll just give you like two examples from where I live. There's a game that happens just down the street from me that is a game of the same guys who've been playing together for the past 10 or 15 years. I played in the game for a while. And it's a good game, but it is basically the people who play in it are guys who run like an oil company locally, or guys that work for Bank of America. Basically, a bunch of fairly well-off white guys. the conversations there are more tilting than anything I've ever heard in my life. And it's to the point to where I had to make a choice. I had to make a choice. I was either going to spend my entire night having to respond to every racist or homophobic comment that I heard, or I just not play there anymore. And I made the decision. I was associating myself with those people voluntarily, and I didn't have to do that. And they weren't going to be convinced, no matter how much I yelled about how I felt about things. And this is, you know, completely different than the whole live among them thing, because I couldn't do anything to convince them otherwise. Meanwhile, there's another game in town, which isn't an exclusive game that you need an invite to, and anybody can show up. And you look around that table, and there's a 60-something woman who is a retiree from New York. There is an African-American man who runs a local cell phone company. You have an Asian kid who has come in from out of town, won a Cherokee event, and then come down here to run a game down here with people. You have, what I'm trying to say is there's also rednecks out of the mountains and hillbillies out of the mountains who come in, and I say that term with affection because I am one. I grew up in the mountains. But, you have all of these people mixing together, and that same kind of conversation with the rich white guys game doesn't happen. You know, yes, there are political discussions, and yes, there are political arguments, but there's a degree of respect for different ideas at this one game than there are at another one. And it's because they are all coming together in a game that is not exclusive. They're not invited to it. They just want to play. And now they're being forced to mix with other ideas. And so they have to, number one, accept the fact that they're sitting next to somebody that maintains a lifestyle that maybe they don't understand. And if they want to play at all. And that, I mean, it's exposure and not closing yourself off in this bubble that where you can believe that everything that you hear on one particular network or one particular Twitter feed is actually true. I'm not necessarily rolled to play in that game on a regular basis, I'd much rather play there than I would at this other game just down the street, because why sit in a bubble for so long?
I really enjoyed, enjoyed is not quite the right word, but maybe had kind of similar experiences when I used to live in Pittsburgh, and I played at the Rivers Casino there, where, I mean, Pittsburgh itself is a pretty liberal place relative to the rest of Pennsylvania. It's like one of two, blue dots that show up on the red map of Pennsylvania. But a lot of the people playing in that game were at least like a good deal more conservative than I was. And they were also like older by a lot than I was. And I didn't generally jump into the conversation directly because I don't think I really had a lot of credibility with them or whatever, but it was interesting just to kind of hear them sort things out even amongst themselves, which is another thing that I think happens at the poker table and maybe not a lot of other places, that this again kind of conflicts a little bit with some other goals we might have for the poker table in terms of making it more gender diverse, but it is like a space where guys get together and talk about things in a way that I think doesn't happen a lot of other spheres. But one of the guys was telling a story about his son, his 7-year-old son. He said he walked into the room and the 7-year-old son had the laptop open and like slammed the lid shut real quick. And he said he was kind of curious what was going on there and looked at the Google history and the son had Googled girls boobies or something like that. And one of the other guys was like, well, at least he wasn't Googling boys peckers. And everybody kind of laughed. And then one of the dudes, he sort of said, oh, not that there's anything wrong with that. And which is, I mean, he like was kind of saying it as a joke, but you could tell he thought it was important to like get that in there. And just like that little, I've really held on to that little anecdote as like a promise of change, just that like someone thought it was important to sort of throw that out there.
Right. I mean, each different day, each new way that we find to talk about a conversation that we wouldn't have talked about before is a step toward change. And hell, we've taken so many steps back over the course of the last, 2 years that we have a lot of steps to take forward again. But, when that kind of thing happens, I'm sounding like, a political activist at this point, which I'm just not, but I'm sort of in that mood this morning. When we do start taking those steps forward, then we can actually feel maybe hopeful again. And the fact that, we are now as a culture talking about how men in power treat women. I mean, who would have thought, that's something we would be discussing right now, but holy cow, isn't it great that we are? Because, we can now advocate for something or feel more comfortable advocating for something that we might have even not brought up, because of, and I'll use a phrase that I heard the other day, which was like moral cowardice. There's this author who lives in Western North Carolina who named David Joy, and he was at a school, I think somewhere up north, and giving a talk, and he was talking about his dad and how his dad was hated Hillary Clinton, and you know would go on the long Trump style rants about her, and how he as a son felt like he had been had dealt with his own cowardice when speaking to his own father, and had vowed not to let that happen again. And which is interesting for this guy, because this guy is, you know, he's younger than I am, and you know, becoming a successful and well-read author, but he also lives in Western North Carolina, which is, if you've been there, it's not somewhere where coastal elites are going to understand. It's Appalachia. And you know, I started listening to this guy a little bit closer because I felt like I understood what he was saying better than I might have understood, you know, someone who was, you know, a far left liberal, or someone I might have listened to on, you know, some liberal network, because he has some credibility as far as I'm concerned. He grew up in a community full of conservatives, and while he, you know, has some socially liberal ideas, he also completely understands where conservatives are coming from. In fact, I'll just make an admission right here. There was a book that came out last year, I think, called Hillbilly Elegy, which I immediately picked up because it spoke to a lot of the kinds of people that I knew growing up and spoke about that. And it got written by a conservative named J.D. Vance. And I read this book and I'm like, now I understand. I feel like I understand everything about how Trump happened and where we are in America, and everything makes sense. And I'm giving the book to my wife and I'm giving it to my friends. I'm like, everybody read this, make sure you understand, because this explains everything. And I did that for like 6 months. And then I started, you know, reading David Joy and listening to him. And he's like, bullshit. That's not what happens. That's not the same people. And I'm like, all right, let's start over then. Let's, you know, talk to me. And, you know, he went on to explain, listen, yeah, that there are some people like that from Appalachia, and that does explain one small subset. But basically this J.D. Vance guy who was, you know, it made you feel like you completely understood the conservative mindset of today among people who aren't wealthy, which is, you know, they came up and they worked their hardest and they did their best and they tried to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, but they couldn't quite make it. And now they have this resentment, yada, yada, yada. And David Joy says, no, absolutely not. I mean, yeah, there are some of those people, but that's not what this community is. That's not what white folks from Appalachia are about. And to narrow everybody down to that kind of subset of people is irresponsible. And while, you know, so while I'm thinking I completely understand everything, I realized I didn't understand anything. And so I started reading again. And so I'll keep reading until I do understand, or maybe write about. I tend to understand things better after I write about them rather than read about them.
Anything else that you would recommend reading that you found particularly helpful?
You know, it's weird. You know, I think the last time we talked was right after I had published this big long form piece about underground poker. Bust, yeah. I think it was right around that time that came out. And so I was reading a ton of long form back then. And I think one weird thing that's happened since the election is that the print space, or even the online print space, which should be unlimited for long form, has been reduced somewhat by the amount of screaming or takes on what's happening politically. And that's not to say there isn't some still really good long form stuff out there, but I haven't read as much of it over the last couple of years simply because, you know, everyone's just trying to keep up with what the hell's going on politically. And so I've spent the last year or so reading two different subsets of things that have nothing to do with, necessarily our culture or how we're talking about things today, but also from people whose ideas that I respect quite a bit. And this David Joy is one of them. And he's a young guy who looks like, you know, he comes out of the mountains with a shotgun on his shoulder and a dog trailing behind him, talking about, you know, all the carp that he caught that morning while he was fishing, but also writes some, you know, pretty insightful things. He had a good essay in The Bitter Southerner, which is where I published that piece that we just talked about, about what it means to be a person from Appalachia. And I can't remember the title off the top of my head, but it's just search David Joy, Bitter Southerner, and you'll find it. And that is the complete response to this whole hillbilly elegy idea. And then, I don't know, I've talked a little bit today just about how I'm trying to better understand where I now call my home. And so I've been reading a lot of local authors who are not nonfiction writers. I mean, they're writing good fiction about what it means to live here. And sort of the poet laureate of where I live is a guy named Ron Rash. And he writes lots of good pieces about what it means to be both a child and adult. And by pieces, I mean, he writes novels about what it means to be a child and adult in the Southeast or South of America. And then there's a couple of guys who are more hyper-local, but still pretty well-known, named George Singleton and Scott Gould, who write really, really super good, but super quirky short stories about, the people of the South. In fact, Singleton actually published one collection called The Half Mammals of Dixie, which pretty much sums up a lot of who we are down here. And then I guess if I'm pimping books, you guys are friends with Martin Harris, or short stack Seamus, he called himself for a while. He writes some of the sweetest stuff, and he wrote a book last year called Obsessica, which is just, it's again just a coming of age novel, but one of the sweetest things ever. And it's a good sort of like mystery, for the seventh grade set. I'm probably more in tune with it because I've got a 13-year-old, and it reminded me a lot of being in that time. I've been reading that, and then I'm working on this super big project that I've been working on for way too long. And so I've been reading a lot of narrative nonfiction, long books, just for the style, and read a ton of really good ones of those. One that actually was probably interesting to the poker community a little bit more is a book called Jackpot, which is by a guy named Jack Ryan. And it's about how the drug running in South Carolina in the 70s and 80s, which is interesting on its own. But what's interesting from a poker player's perspective is that it was that very investigation and that very big, big bust that resulted from that, that sort of kicked off the idea of how the government could use civil forfeiture in America. And that was really where it started. The current governor of South Carolina was a U.S. attorney at the time, named Henry McMaster. And he came up with this idea. It's like, what if we just take their houses? Then we can bust the drug dealers, which, worked for them at the time. But now, you try to drive down the street with, 20 grand in your pocket, they can just take it from you. And so it's a good, good understanding of where that began.
The other thing that we talked some about, I mean, we kind of briefly mentioned it today, but the last time that you were on the show was feeling like the poker players had become less interesting, or the personalities had diminished. And I know you mentioned Jason Kuhn. Are there other people that you look at who have kind of come to prominence in the last 2 years who you find particularly interesting in the poker world?
Yes, but I hate to like say this person's interesting and this person isn't, simply because I feel
let's
like
say what's something interesting about them is on display, has been well displayed.
Yeah, I guess I like people who are kind. I think, whether it's poker Twitter or it's being on the road and meeting people, I think this idea that we can exist as a poker community and talk to each other and build, a reputation for ourselves and a whole new conversation has been interesting. I could either listen to or read Jamie Kerstetter's poker stuff or just jokes all day long. I mean, she is, as far as I'm concerned, better comedy and more insightful stuff than anybody else online right now. I really enjoy reading her, and I think she's going to actually have her own podcast soon. So I'll be interested to hear that. But I think any poker player who takes the opportunity to speak kindly to other people at their table, to represent their job and represent their game very well in the media, and doesn't take the opportunity to try to destroy basically the whole idea of community that we'd like to put together. Anyway, those are my favorite people, and I would much rather spend my time writing about them than writing about people who are cheating people, which still happens every once in a while, or people who just start arguments for the sake of arguments. I'm not the guy that when something starts up on Twitter, they immediately put up a popcorn GIF and say let's start watching, let's get into it. It's just not me. I tune out a lot faster than I'll tune into something like that.
I wish I could say the same. It's really kind of a, I don't like the word guilty pleasure, but I mean, it's a, like, I don't think it's a good thing, and I would prefer not to engage in it myself and prefer it didn't happen, but I do nonetheless when there's like juicy drama. Even it doesn't happen as much on 2+2 anymore, but I mean, the like dramas in the poker world, I do find them entertaining for the most part.
I mean, I guess I'm sort of conflict averse anyway for the most part, and while
if it comes to me being personally involved in it, I very much am, but I'll sit on the sidelines and watch other people blow themselves up.
I laughed at myself last week because I'm like, I'm in a Twitter fight, but I was basically battling with a guy who was trying to compare the Roy Moore sexual predator Alabama senatorial candidate with Ted Kennedy and Chappaquiddick. And all of a sudden found myself, yelling on Twitter and yelling on the internet, which you shouldn't do.
Well, that's probably a pretty good place to lay it off, unless there was more that you were hoping to talk about, or if you feel like we haven't drilled him for enough recommendations yet. I've got a page, literally half a page of stuff I want to put show notes to on here.
Yeah, no, I mean it's great. I could talk to Brad all day if he was willing, but we have to end sometime, and I think we found a good spot to end it on. I just want to say again, you'll always be Brad Otis Willis to me.
So. Well, I appreciate that. That still pops up, in various places from time to time, and creating a pseudonym to hide your identity a long time ago, and then having that still be your identity when you really just want your name to be out there on your own is sort of interesting. But it's where I came from and who I am, and like I said, I've had a blog since before I was hoping to be famous for having a blog, and I'm happy to be Brad Otis Willis. But listen, I mean, I guess thank you guys for having me on, because I don't necessarily have a lot of opportunities to talk to poker people about things that aren't poker, and so I appreciate that. I've spent a lot of time just the last week writing and talking with people about mental health issues, both among poker people and just society in general, and it's good to be able to talk to people who are in the same profession and community that I am about issues that aren't necessarily related to what we do to make money.
Oh, well, it's certainly our pleasure.
Thanks, guys.
Take care.
Thank you. For a world that could take away the pain. Sleepless nights, do I need some kind of pill? Or the devotion of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill?
I'm doing well, and I hope you are too. Which ends it right there. There's no, I don't have to say anything. He's expressed concern for my well-being, but that's it. The conversation's over, and we can both feel good about it.
I like that a lot.
I hope you are too. Yeah, just use that. I'm doing well. That. I hope you are too. We're done. Thank
you. Although you've confirmed my fear about wasting good material.